is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
The President of the United States, Mr. Biden, August 16, 2023. Name me a single objective we've ever set out to accomplish that we've failed on. Name me one. In all of our history, not one. End quote. I welcome Victor Davis Hanson, a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, writing most recently of The American Greatness. The date is of significance. August 16th, 2023 is 2 years exactly from the withdrawal, the flight, the abandonment, the disgrace of leaving Kabul, and thousands of people who are vulnerable to the depredations of the Taliban because they aided, assisted, and believed in the United States of America for 20 years. Victor, a very good evening to you. That policy still has not been adequately addressed, and I believe we will do this every August until it is. The abandonment of Afghanistan not only was a tragedy that on a human level, we all know Afghan nationals who are in this country and have relatives back home and worry about them all the time. However, Afghanistan had other effects that are profound now. How did Afghanistan lead to Ukraine? What was the connection? And if Mr. Biden won't recognize it, certainly the historians will. Good evening to you, Victor.
Good evening. There were four things that the president did that Vladimir Putin interpreted as appeasement to be reciprocated with aggression. First, of course, was he was very slow in sending offensive weapons that had been, you know, denied during the Obama administration. And then Trump had greenlighted the javelins and other things. And then we were slow walking them again. And second, of course, was the Afghan debacle of August 2021. And Putin saw that and he said, you know, if they're going to leave from the Taliban, they're surely not going to be very muscular in helping Ukraine. The third was Biden had told Vladimir Putin, if your Russian hackers continue, at least lay off some humanitarian targets. Pipelines, hospitals, etc. And then most importantly, he said that he asked what would the United States do if Putin invaded Ukraine? And he said it depended on whether it was a minor invasion or not. And Putin interpreted that probably wrongly, that the West in general, the United States in particular, wouldn't do anything. And then he put that calculus into a larger analysis of the U.S. border, draining the strategic petroleum reserve, cutting back on our own fossil fuels while begging Iran and indeed Russia too, and Venezuela, Saudi Arabia to pump more oil that we would not. And he just concluded, John, that the United States was not up to deterring him in Ukraine. And he'd known that, most importantly, that Joe Biden had been vice president under Barack Obama and point man from Ukraine, as Joe reminded us in 2018 before the Foreign Relations Committee, Foreign Relations lecture circuit. He had reminded us that he was point man in Ukraine and, of course, Burisma and all of that entailed. So I don't think Putin was very scared or worried that the Biden administration would deter him.
And the drip of weapons and policy since the beginning of the conflict, February 24th, 2022. Does the president see that as a success? Because now we're talking F-16s. A year ago, the Secretary of State was embarrassed one weekend when he said F-16s and the White House canceled him. So is this another one of Mr. Biden's successful policies?
I don't know what we would call it, because there's a general rule about Ukraine. Every weapon system that Joe Biden ruled was impermissible, that he would not send it to Ukraine, was sent to Ukraine. And what was ironic about that, he gave very vehement lectures about he did not want to be at the threshold of World War III and give them fill in the blanks, F-16s, shore-to-ship missiles, Abrams tanks, Bradley fighting vehicles, etc. And then each time that he green-lighted a particular weapon system, he said it was essential, forgetting, of course, that the American people had been told by him that they were provocative. So that's sort of like the border, and sort of like energy, and sort of like crime, and sort of like inflation, and sort of like interest rates. He makes no impression on him at all. He's just not worried about the effect that his policies have on people, the United States, the American citizens, the country at large.
The Iran deal. The president inherited the Abraham Accords, and there was comity throughout the Middle East, strikingly so, for the first time in perhaps 1,000, 2,000 years. And the president quickly turned aside MBS and his offices, Saudi Arabia being the driver for much of the contretemps for the last 40 years, and sought a deal with Iran about the suspect nuclear weapons program, and now comes to negotiating for transferring billions of dollars to Iran. No one thinks that a success, and the fact that the president is unaware of it is odd, Victor. What about the Iran deal? What does he want?
It's in tatters. The Iranians looked at it and they said, why would we even deal with Biden? We'll just do what we want. We don't have to reify it or formalize it. We're just going to enrich uranium. And the envoy that we sent over there, Robert Malley, had a long history of tilting toward Iran. And now that he's been dismissed for disclosing allegedly classified information, we have no point man. The subtext of that was that the Obama administration appointees who created it are either still in office or their surrogates are. And what was the rationale behind it was, A, to punish the Netanyahu government and Israel they don't like, and B, very crackpot idea to create an alternate nexus of Iran, Syria, Lebanon, Hezbollah, Hamas as a counterpoint to the moderate Arab regimes in Israel, and therefore create sort of interesting tension between the two groups. And then each one would have to come to the United States for help, but we wouldn't any longer favor the only democracy in the Middle East, Israel.
We turn to the border. Because the story is unfinished, I don't have numbers anymore. It seems to be a constant flow of migrants coming north. I know that the Darien Gap has never seen more migrants coming through from all over the world, including Chinese nationals. The president regards this as a success. Is that correct?
Yes, he does. And I don't know why. I think there's a pattern here, John, that if he destroys the border and 7 million entrants come across, and then in a particular month in which he's speaking, it's 100,000 illegal entrants go down to, say, 50,000. Or if the inflation rate has for the year been 8%, or in terms of fuel and staples, maybe 25%. But in a particular month in which he's speaking, it goes down to, say, 5%. Then he terms that temporary success a generic success. And that's what he's doing. But he doesn't look at the number of people who have crossed the border. He only looks at the number of people who cross the border in comparison with the flood that just preceded it. But he doesn't go back to the baseline during the Trump administration at the end of that administration. But behind all of this, John, there's a rationale and agenda. It's not just chaos. He does not believe in the border. He thinks that the more immigrants that come in, the more entitlements and needs they'll have to draw on the federal government, the larger the government, and then someday the larger the Democratic constituency.
Fentanyl. The precursors come from China. The Sinaloa cartels and others cook them and send them north. You list 100,000 deaths in 2022. That's a conservative number. I will speak to reporting from Selena Zito in Pittsburgh that downtown Pittsburgh is appalled and destroyed by the drug addiction and the abuse of fentanyl and other drugs in one particular city, the second largest city in Pennsylvania. The story is repeated across the country. The president, does he have a policy about fentanyl?
No, he looks at the Obrador government in Mexico as a constructive partner, even though probably 30% of the Mexican government is actively working with the cartels. He doesn't want to pressure Obrador the way Trump did. And remember that Obrador said publicly, he called on all expatriate Mexican citizens and green card holders and voters that were second and third generation American citizens. He said, support the Democratic Party, go out and vote against Donald Trump and the Republicans. And so in Biden's calculus, he's got a partner and the partner deserves certain exemptions. That's one part of it. The other part of it is he has a particular disdain for the white working class, which he calls the, he's called them the chumps, the dregs, the semi-fascists, the ultra-megas, kind of continuing the abuse of the Clinton, Hillary Clinton's irredeemables and deplorables and Barack Obama's clingers. And you really see that with the complete neglect of East Palestine, Ohio, that working class community that the president would not visit. I mention that, John, because fentanyl, while it cuts across classes and races and ethnic groups, it does seem to concentrate on the white working class within the middle of the country. And that particular demographic has the highest suicide rate of any group by race and by age and by gender. And by the way, they're also the same group who in Iraq and Afghanistan die at double their demographics. 74% of all combat deaths in Iraq, about 75% in Afghanistan came from that very group, even though they represent probably only about 34, 35% of the population.
And creating credit, printing money, $6 trillion. The story is unfinished. Can we solve the inflation story that is a direct result of government spending these last years? The Trump administration, but especially the Biden administration in the recovery. But I go to the one that is the most damaging to my measure. That is the undermining of confidence in the Department of Justice and the FBI. I don't know how it's going to come back, Victor. I thought Russiagate was difficult, but now with these additional Biden policies, Merrick Garland's favoritism, there's doubt everywhere about justice.
I think we're getting a very dangerous territory because I think even the left is starting to conclude that Joe Biden and the Biden family is corrupt and that Joe Biden is the only obstacle between them and a rendezvous with justice. Just recently, we've seen reports that Hunter Biden's lawyers were essentially blackmailing the president by saying to the Department of Justice, if you do not give this sweetheart deal to Hunter, we may have to call the president of the United States as a witness. And that's the last thing they wanted, for Joe Biden to testify under oath on behalf of his son, which would put him in, I think, a lot of perjury territory. And of course, we had Hunter Biden doing the art. And why would anybody under such scrutiny create this childish art and then try to hawk it at a profit that would embarrass his father? And then, of course, we had the laptop references to Mr. the big guy and Mr. 10%. And then he said at one point that he was very upset that half of his income was siphoned off by Joe Biden. They have a very strange relationship. And I think that explains why all of a sudden Hunter is kept very close to Joe and he's in the White House right now.
I'm speaking with Victor Davis Hanson of the Hoover Institution. I'm John Batchelor.